The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes. Welcome to the Space Show, an hour of exploring new frontiers and exciting opportunities in outer space. Here is your host, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. This is your host, David Livingston. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show, and thank you for tuning in and being here. As you see, when I will introduce our guest in just a minute, we've had a slight schedule change due to some travel complications. So we have one of my favorite guests returning to the Space Show tonight, Dr. John Brandenburg.
Thanks, Dave.
Let me first tell you a little bit about the show and how you can participate with us. And I know that Dr. Brandenburg would enjoy your participation as well. If you are in the greater Seattle area, you're able to call us on 425-373-5527. If you're outside of Seattle, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And on the toll-free number, remember, there are no call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered. You're always on the air as soon as it is answered, but you may need to wait until we finish what it is we're doing before we get to you. And then if you want to use email or chat to talk with us, the email addresses are dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And if you're working with ICQ, AOL's Instant Messenger, or CompuServe, the screen name is all one word, Space Show Chat. And don't forget, all of the programs are archived. You can visit and hear them anytime you want, as long as you have Windows Media Player. Just go to www.thespaceshow.com. You can also see the newsletter there. It's uploaded every Monday. And you can also see the subscription window if you would like an email subscription to the newsletter. Just send that in to us. Make sure you can receive a mass mailing message from Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. So if you're running a spam filter, you might want to open a window for that. And also visit the Space Show store. You'll see a big button on the website for that. And you will also see a button for supporting the Space Show. If you think that what we're doing is worthwhile and you share the vision of going into space and becoming spacefaring as we do, we'd certainly appreciate your help. That button takes you directly to a PayPal link. And any help and support you can give the program is greatly appreciated. And then just before I introduce our guest to us, just to let you know that we're going to do two trivia questions tonight. And for those of you that can answer them correctly, or the first one to answer each of the questions correctly, I should say, you will win either the Space Trivia book or the CD album that I've been giving away the past couple of weeks, To Touch the Stars. And before I read the question, I will certainly tell you for which prize you are trying to win. And to win, you need to use one of the phone numbers and call the show. Email and chat are not allowed until the last few minutes, and then we open it up for anyone. And, of course, if our guest, Dr. Brandenburg, knows the answer, he doesn't win a thing. So that tells you the idea of the flavor of the show tonight, right, John?
That's right. Okay, I've been forewarned.
Dr. Brandenburg,
even if I know the answer, I can't say it.
Dr. Brandenburg is a very well-known Mars scientist. He is also now a very well-known science fiction author, although he uses another name for the sci-fi work, Victor Norgard. And his
big
book,
secret, don't tell anybody.
Well, then they can't buy the book. The book is Morning Star Pass, The Collapse of the UFO Cover-Up. You know, even though it's science fiction, and we actually did a show and talked about that, John, and I'll get to the rest of your bio in a second, but if there turns out to be life on Mars, won't that hasten a collapse of the UFO cover-up if the rovers and the European science experiments really do confirm some type of life on Mars? What happens to your book?
Well, it's one of the premises of the book, and that it's set 10 years in the future. And in 10 years in the future, well, actually, it's 2010, actually. It's, everyone accepts the idea there is life on Mars, that there was life on Mars and there is, and that is, in fact, what one thing that enables people to get over this hurdle about now intelligent life, that suddenly the cosmos is alive and it's actually in our face.
Intelligent life is in our face?
That's right. It's, well,
where?
Science fiction novel.
Maybe intelligent life is on Mars, right?
Well, no, not on Mars. Well, actually, I talk about the face on Mars is mentioned in the book as kind of emblematic of the idea of unknown intelligence in the cosmos. It doesn't actually, in the book, it doesn't actually state that it is a sign of a dead civilization.
But, you know, if
that'll be left for a later book, which is, you know, science. One of the reasons I wrote a science fiction novel, and I wrote it under a pen name at the request of my literary agent, Dead Mars, Dying Earth, simply because he wanted me to keep my science writing and my science fiction writing well separated. And one thing, writing under a pen name gives you is very liberating. Mark Twain could write stuff that Sam Clemens never would have owned up to. I mean, in my novel, it's a fairly swashbuckling novel. There is a princess with a starship in there, and who comes in near the end. And, you know, there's the U.S. Marines storming hidden alien bases, and U.S. Air Force planes bombing another Air Force base.
And this is 10 years.
Dr. Strangelove, you know, it gets pretty intense.
And this is 2010, right? Not 2004.
2010, 2011. Not 2004. It's about 6 or 7 years in the future. And one of the ideas, you know, it's an exploring of a scenario. What if there was intelligent life in the cosmos and it actually visited us, and the U.S. government knew that something at Roswell had actually happened. So the government knew that, and then had neither the intelligent species or the U.S. government itself saw it in their interest to reveal that. And so they had played this strange game over the last 50 years. And that something ultimately they had, and this is an historic fact that, you know, there were a lot of UFO sightings finally right over Washington D.C. itself. You had jet fighters chasing unidentified flying objects over the Capitol. So in the book, this had basically, things had basically evolved so that the government finally tried to contact the aliens and finally succeeded. And once it succeeded in communicating with them, they began negotiating to find out what they wanted, how they could, and of course this is only one species out of several. The Earth in this novel turns out to be in the center of the sun, solar system turns out to be in the center of kind of a Romulan neutral zone in the galaxy. And many different species are here, but only one species is trying really to actively intervene here. And, so I tried to then, a science fiction writer tries to adopt the idea, what if, to make one reasonable premise or one new thing, and then kind of let that be a seed crystal of the rest of reality as we know it, kind of crystallizes around. And so in this novel, we have a secret government, something that people weren't as concerned with when I was writing the novel, but of course are very much concerned with now. You have a secret government that basically is not even telling the president what they're doing.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, and so they consider, and one of the sayings in the book, and it's on the cover, is that absolute secrecy creates absolute power. If you have an absolutely secret operation, then in that little, you have an island of absolute power, something that no one in the U.S. government is supposed to have. And we all know what absolute power does to people.
Yes, it makes them better people, John.
And you're right, Dave, and that's just what happens in this book.
And we have a break about to come up. So real quickly, let me tell the audience that Dr. Brandenburg is much, much more than a sci-fi writer. He's at the Florida Space Institute. He came from the Aerospace Corporation. He is a physicist first rate. He go read his bio on the website on my newsletter. The music is blaring.
I'm a physicist, by the way, and second a science fiction writer.
And the music is blaring in my ear, so we're going to have this break right away. But he's here to talk about methane and life and what the rovers are doing on Mars, as well as have a little fun. Stay right where you are. We'll be right back with Dr. John Brandenburg and Victor Norgaard.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring The Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018. Or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back to The Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston, and our guest today is Dr. John Brandenburg. John, before we go back to your book, I want to look at what has been happening with the information from the rovers and also the European Mars Express, because all of a sudden we have been getting information about water, oceans, methane. The Italians, scientists with Mars Express, are finding formaldehyde and other very short-lived gases, which I guess are the residue of biology decaying on Mars. And I'm assuming their science and Mars Express is comparable to what we do. We don't hear much from NASA, and the president has a proposal to go to the moon and go to Mars. And an Aldrich Committee report says, yeah, let's go do it. And don't you think that this stuff should be put in our faces by the New York Times and every place saying, hey, look, there's probably life on Mars. Maybe there's life there today, even if it's just a little piece of biology. We got to get up there and find out about it and shake hands with it. But it's not happening.
Well, we're lost on Earth right now. You know, it's an election year, and they have much bigger fish to fry. And speaking of Fry, you know, Amber Fry testified on today.
About Mars?
Yes. she said, I believe they're out there. So, I mean, this stuff's far more important than finding little strange stuff on Mars.
Let's see, that would be there are the real killers for O.J. and Scott. Is that right?
That's right. They're up there.
They're out there someplace.
O.J.'s looking for the real killers of his wife. They're up on Mars.
Well, I guess, you know, if we have the O.J. jurors as the typical general population, and we're talking about going to Mars to these people, they're probably thinking we're going to go get a Mars candy bar.
Exactly. You know, I think the fact that we're in an election year, of course, we have a war going on in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and the two Russian airliners apparently disappeared tonight.
I know.
We have a global war going on, and this is distracting people from the fact that we're basically losing our virginity as far as the cosmos is concerned. We're only going to realize, we're only going to discover once as a species, you know, kind of in a public way, that we're not alone in the universe, and we're doing it right now. We're in the middle. This, if you want to know what it feels like to be in the middle of a big scientific quantum leap, that's what we're going through right now. In the last decade, really the last 5 years, our understanding of what has happened on Mars, which is the first planet in the cosmos that we can go to that's reasonably like Earth, that where we reasonably expect to find Earth-like biology. We're going there, and we're finding all of the signs of, as I told one friend, we've found no smoking guns on Mars yet, but we found a lot of smoke, and we found some guns. So we just have to find one that's smoking.
So the formaldehyde and some of these other short-lived gases are not smoking guns?
Let me put it this way. The people in Italy learned very well from what happened to Dave McKay and his group at Houston.
Mm-hmm.
They found what I consider to be fairly convincing evidence of life on Mars in LH8401. I believe that recognizing life, everything that life does can be done inorganically. This, you know, there's organic processes. The difference between chemistry that nature does without life and, or inorganic chemistry, chemistry in just a hot spring, and chemistry that life does is that life does it all at once in one place. Life has thousands of chemical reactions, thousands of chemicals, thousands of signatures, and they all happen at one place, whereas, a lot of other things in nature happen kind of in a very scattered way, like one at a time. So recognizing life is basically pattern recognition. It's seeing the fingerprint. And that's the problem. Much of science right now is based on the idea of breaking things down and examining each little bit. It's like a court case. And it's kind of, you know, it's rather adversarial at times. I mean, people will say, you know, they'll attack the witnesses. You know, suddenly the trial won't be about the person on trial. It'll be about the character of the witness who's giving evidence against them. And so instead of looking at the whole pattern, like in ALH8401, where you found a bunch of carbonates, you found magnetites, you found organic chemicals, all in a one big clustered area right in the center of the rock, people would say, well, we find organic chemicals like this in other places. But then they forget that they didn't find them with carbonates or magnetites, et cetera. So they tend to dissect everything. But basically, we're seeing all of the patterns of life. And as I said, recognizing life is recognizing patterns, a group of things, an ensemble. So we're seeing all of the things. For one thing, we're getting meteorites from Mars. They're showing signs of life, of past life. Now, the earthly telescopes are much better than they ever used to be. And we're looking at Mars with very, very good telescopes now, super sophisticated telescopes, including the Hubble. And we're finding things like methane in the atmosphere. Now, there's a report that they found formaldehyde, and perhaps even ammonia. I looked at the spectra myself. And looking at spectra is like looking at fingerprints and trying to identify groups of lines that belong, usually are associated with certain chemicals on Earth. And the problem is the discoveries we're making are so momentous. If they find like ammonia and formaldehyde, well, like, take ammonia was one of the things that is suspected. They showed the spectra, and they showed on one website, I think it was the European Mars Express, they showed the spectra and they showed the place where there was perhaps ammonia. The problem is ammonia is such a very strong indicator of life because the ammonia molecule is very fragile and it wouldn't last more than a few hours in the Martian atmosphere. That means it must be produced continually. That means life right now on Mars.
But basic life, it doesn't have to be advanced life.
No, it's very basic, just bacterial life under the surface. And so, unfortunately, that is such a red flag to the rest of the scientific community that after seeing what happened to McKay and the people at Houston, they were attacked from 15 different directions, people picking apart their arguments. And the people in Europe, unless they have absolutely conclusive evidence, they're probably rather reluctant to say, oh, we think we found ammonia, unless they actually have a probe walking, you know, a rover that can smell ammonia on Mars, they're probably not going to say so, simply because they just don't want to take the heat. It takes a certain amount of audacity to announce a big discovery.
What would
because all the people who wanted to make that discovery instead become your enemies?
Would NASA and JPL be willing to accept at arm's length an announcement based upon the science of Mars Express, or would they thumb their nose at it or look down on it?
Oh, you underestimate the competitive nature of the personalities in science. They would probably be very skeptical of any announcement of ammonia, and they would find 15 different sources for ammonia that weren't biological. They'd say, well, there must be a hot spring down there someplace. Now, of course, the hot spring is also the best place to find life on Mars because most of Mars is pretty cold, like a desert in Antarctica. In fact, even colder than that. And so, basically, you have to get really definitive evidence for, like, a ammonia a pattern of life. There's another problem with ammonia. And that is that ammonia has big absorption lines that are very close to the absorption and emission lines for carbon dioxide, which is the major constituent of Mars' atmosphere. So any ammonia in the Martian atmosphere is just a trace amount, and then you have this enormous signal from the nearby CO2 bands.
Mm-hmm.
So ammonia is an excellent bioindicator. I mean, it's very difficult to explain ammonia in the atmosphere if it was present unless microbes were there. However, the signal is so dwarfed by the carbon dioxide signal there that you just have to be – scientists don't like to be wrong, especially about claiming something important. So the more important the discovery, in this case – removing the human race from being the center of the biological universe to being just a little pebble. So that's a very important announcement, and it's going to be made sometime in the near future by somebody, but people are very, very nervous about making that announcement unless they have absolutely ironclad evidence. However, at the same time, we are learning more and more about Mars. They have meteorites on Mars. They show evidence of life. We have the rovers roving around on the surface. They've found evidence for a lot of liquid water in the past. We know that liquid water and life are kind of inseparable. If there's one, there's probably the other. And also we have now these observations of, the methane. And methane, by the way, is a fairly rugged molecule. It can survive in the Martian atmosphere for about 700 years, but that means it has to be continually replenished. So there are only the sources for methane in nature on Earth are from volcanic activity or biology. Bovine flatulence is a good example. There's a lot of bacteria that live in the guts of cows. and it makes a lot of methane. Also, of course, coal seams and, of course, petroleum deposits have a lot of natural gas, and the natural gas is mostly methane, CH4. Now, they've also think they may have found formaldehyde. Now, formaldehyde is a much more unstable molecule than methane. It only lasts for 7.5 hours. However, if you have methane in the Martian atmosphere, the action is ultraviolet. It's constantly beating up the molecules there. You will get some formaldehyde formed by the breakdown of methane. So formaldehyde is not as good a bioindicator as like ammonia. However, methane itself is a perfectly good bioindicator.
What?
Let me tell you something. They actually found these first evidence for methane on Mars back in 1969 with the Mariner 9 mission. But they only had one reading, and the idea of finding methane in the Martian atmosphere at that time was considered so outrageous that they just dropped it like a live hand grenade. They didn't want to touch it.
What is the evidence going to be that confirms or makes scientists feel safe in saying, you know, there's life on Mars, even if it's a very primitive or basic life? What's the collaborative evidence? Is it going to be?
I think finding a pattern of gases, if they confirm, you know, the signal for ammonia looked like it was there. They tentatively identified it, but they just didn't have a warm feeling about it. I think that as the technology gets better, you know, now they'll be able to fly a probe to Mars to look at Mars closely, and it will be optimized for finding ammonia.
Would you believe them? Do you think they would be truthful about what they find?
Oh, yes. I have a colleague at work, a very astute fellow, and one of the things I prize in him is he's very skeptical about everything I say. He wants to test everything. He was saying to me the other day over lunch, John, life on Mars, it's pretty passe now. I think we're pretty satisfied. And so he being a skeptic is pretty much will not be shocked that there's life on Mars. He doesn't consider it that big a deal anymore. I mean, in terms of bacterial life. So, he basically said that, you know, this idea had lost all of its excitement because there was no more tension. There was no more tension there. You know, it's like, who shot JR? Well, we know who shot JR now.
Well, why wouldn't the administration or the space advocates or somebody, NASA people, JPL people, why wouldn't they latch onto this to help drive the interest and the desire to see this return to the moon on to Mars space program get implemented? It would seem to me that this would just, you know, knock the bonkers off of everybody, and we need to get up there.
Well, I've talked to James Garvin, who's the guy in charge of Mars exploration, and he is hot on the trail of this. He has made the discovery of life on Mars, either past or present, to be the goal of Mars exploration. It's like, you know, when you're hunting for something and people start saying, well, you're warm, you're warmer, getting warmer, you're hot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're hot now. We've been warm for a while, and we're kind of spiraling in. We've picked up the hounds have picked up the scent, and we're hot on the trail now. And basically, he explained that they defined the problem of finding liquid water. Follow the water.
Okay, hold it right there. We have our break. So everybody stay right where you are. We'll pick up our thread on liquid water. We'll introduce the trivia questions to you, and we'll start taking your questions when we come back from this break.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring the Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back to the Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Dr. John Brandenburg. And before we return to Dr. Brandenburg, let me throw out the trivia question. So again, the rule is you have to use the phone and call us and say hello, answer the question correctly, maybe ask a question of Dr. Brandenburg, maybe even stump him if you can do that. And so here, for those of you who would like to try to win the book, Space Trivia, by former astronaut William Pogue, first one to call in on 1-866-687-7223 with the correct answer, you win the book. And the question is, who was the first woman to fly in space? Now, for those of you who would like the CD, the first one to call in on that same toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223, and can answer this question, you get the CD. And the question is, which newspaper editorialized against the funding of rocket research by Dr. Robert Goddard? And I'll give you a hint. This was in 1920, January 18th, 1920. Well, back to Mars, John. Are we going to see any political capital come from this group of discoveries surrounding water, methane, and these other gases?
I think the discovery of life indicators on Mars is going to basically help the Bush administration. Apparently the election is going to be decided by the undecided, who are a notoriously quirky group anyway. So whatever makes this administration look good in terms of finding life on Mars will have to be interpreted by everybody as success of the space program. In fact, it's a big success. I equate it to the Copernican Revolution, which where the human race realized it wasn't the center of the universe. It was actually just a planet orbiting a star. And that, by the way, took about 300 years to sink in. It wasn't that people ran screaming down the street saying Copernicus has explained it when Copernicus published his book. In fact, he was smart enough to make sure he was dead before the book got published, because he knew that people didn't take kindly to being removed from the center of the universe. It was a big demotion. And it took a long time. Finally, it turned out the Copernican system was the simplest way to explain the motion of the planets that they could observe from Earth. Remember, they didn't have space probes in those days. All they had was guys looking out their backyards, basically. And then finally they had good telescopes. And it turns out the motions of the planets were best explained by Copernicus, and then Kepler improved the Copernican orbits, which were originally circles, and he made them ellipses. And this gave the best explanation mathematically for the orbits of the planets. And by far the thing that won out in the end, it was simple. Occam's razor operated here. You could explain the orbit of the planets with 40 epicycles, but nobody could explain why the planets would move in these complicated epicycles, whereas Kepler's explanation was some attractive force like magnetism was pulling them around the sun. So at the same time, we are going through a Copernican revolution ourselves, and it's a psychological revolution, and is, you know, it's a philosophical and psychological revolution as well as a scientific one. That's one of the reasons this is taking so long. This is the human race losing its virginity, and it can only do it once.
We have a caller, John, so can you give us your first name and where you're calling from, please?
John Powell from Sacramento is answering the trivia question.
Ah, hi, John. How you doing?
Oh, doing real good.
Which one are you answering?
The one for Robert Goddard.
Okay.
Newspaper. I believe it was the New York Times.
Yes, that esteemed newspaper. Do you actually know what they said?
They had commented that everyone knows, or every elementary school educated child should know that since the space is a vacuum, there's nothing to push against, therefore you cannot use a rocket to get to the moon.
That's right, and then they said that he lacks the knowledge laid out daily in high schools. And then they apologized in 1969.
Oh my
to
God.
Him,
it
even though he had,
time.
Even though he had been dead for 20 years.
It took a while.
Any questions or comments for Dr. Brandenburg?
Just one question: would he like to personally go to Mars?
Absolutely. In fact, God willing, I will be on Mars someday in a spacesuit, kicking rocks, throwing rocks into the Thales Marineris.
John, make sure you email me your mailing address for the CD.
Oh, well,
absolutely.
Excellent program today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your tuning in.
Thank you.
Okay. I have an interesting email question for you that wants to take you to task. Are you ready for this one?
Absolutely.
Sam in Casper, Wyoming is listening in on the Internet. Thank you, Sam. Sam in Sam, S-A-M.
S-A-M? Oh, Sam, okay.
Sam, Casper, Wyoming is where he says he's from.
Be it far for me to argue with anybody from Casper, Wyoming.
That's right. But what he says is, I disagree with you thinking that they would want, that this administration would favor anything about life on Mars and that it would favor the Bush administration in this election. Don't forget, Dr. Brandenburg, that this is the administration that opposes moving forward scientifically with cloning and stem cell research on moral and religious high ground, especially when you hear either Mr. or Mrs. Bush talk. What makes you think that they wouldn't see life on Mars or even a very basic primitive form of ET as an agent outside their acceptable value system of religion, ethics, and morality, and absolutely fight hard to oppose any science that had anything to do with life on Mars of any nature, of any type, of any sort, for any reason?
Sam, you've raised a very interesting issue, and that is, how much violence will discovering life on Mars do to our religious beliefs? And I'm only an Episcopalian, but I can say that I'm fully prepared to be just a speck of dust in the universe, just one speck of dust of many. Now, you've also mentioned that religion gets involved in a lot of scientific issues, the stem cell debate and the cloning debate. I myself think the Bush administration would like to find life on Mars, for one thing, so it can it'll be good for the space program, which means it'll carry Florida without a recount. But there are powerful forces in this society who are very upset about the idea of finding life on other planets. They still haven't digested the idea of evolution.
Well, especially those who are listening in Kansas, right?
Right. Well, in Kansas, the state legislature, I can't remember which year, actually mandated that the number pi, constant pi, was actually 3, exactly 3, rather than 3.14. Fortunately, they didn't mandate that for any civil engineers in Kansas. It was basically, because in the Bible it says that the pillars of the Solomon's Temple were 3 times around as they were across, and this is interpreted, since the Bible said it implied it was exactly 3, we must have gotten, the Greeks who were, of course, not were pagans and worshipped strange gods like Zeus and Jupiter and Mars. They must have gotten it wrong. But anyway, Sam, yes, science and politics are woven together. And I've heard many sermons from the pulpit in fundamentalist churches. I used to be a fundamentalist, and before just becoming an Episcopalian
and a physicist, right?
And, well, I was when I was younger, and as I got more educated, I changed my religious beliefs somewhat. But as I say, I'm still a Christian. I still go to church. I go to an Episcopalian church. However, many sermons I heard said there was no extraterrestrial life, and you know how a minister in the church could make such a definitive claim. And you know, I've looked through the Bible. There's no basis in the Bible for making such a statement. But science and politics are very much woven together. Things like cold fusion are resisted not just because people think it's bad science. Turns out it may have been better science than people thought, but also because it would portend the great change. It would mean a changing around of our whole energy economy. And a lot of money that's presently in one group of hands might move to another group of hands. And the human race is inherently conservative. It doesn't like change. Even it's taken the human race a long time to get the idea that some change might be good. And so what I'm trying to say is that I think that modern society we live in, both Democrat and Republican, look on the discovery of life on other planets as a good thing, as human progress. Now, the stem cell debate, I think that's another matter that involves basically what some people interpret as debate over respect for human life. And that debate's always going to be with us. Things like capital punishment and euthanasia get into the same thing. However, anyway, Sam, I hope I've answered your question. But at the same time, one of the reasons I wrote this science fiction novel, just to get back to that, is that in there, the ultimate political question is how close are we to being in contact with not just life in the universe, but intelligent life, technological life? We would like to become, and my vision for the future, in fact, is the same as Dave's, is that the human race will become a fully spacefaring, sovereign species in the cosmos, and that one day we will join a greater community of peoples out there that I believe are out there. I mean, if we find life on Mars, we find even bacterial life on Mars, that means there is intelligence out there also. We don't know how far away it is. We don't know if they can get here. A host of other questions then arise. In fact, one of the problems with finding life on Mars is for some people, they have a nice closed universe where everything is kind of explained through a continual chain of cause and effect. Once you say there's extraterrestrial life and intelligence, suddenly your little world isn't closed anymore. I mean, Hernando Cortez and his conquistadors could arrive in starships any day. And suddenly your whole world be thrown into confusion, as it was for like the Aztecs in Mexico and the other Native American nations in Mexico. People they hadn't even conceived of suddenly arrived. Their world was completely destroyed by something completely extrinsic to the universe that they had conceived of. And it's partly that since we're mindful of that part of our history, we have to be open to the fact that if we find life on Mars, then space exploration and becoming spacefaring become, in a sense, imperative. We no longer have a choice. The universe isn't our private sandbox anymore. In fact, it behooves us to kind of go out and occupy the Moon and Mars so that somebody else can't arrive in the solar system and decide that they will occupy them. I'm speaking, of course, of science fiction scenarios, but I will tell you that once we find life on Mars definitively, and as I believe we are finding it now, we are in the middle of that process, we are now in a science fiction scenario. We are in a scenario of a part of human history that has only been explored in science fiction. And if we look to science fiction for a guide for how we will adjust to this, things could get pretty dramatic. But I think that the direction for the human race, there's only one direction, and that is outward. And the first place we can go in the whole cosmos that looks remotely like Earth is Mars. We're finding evidence for life there. That means the universe is a living universe, that we look at the stars at night. Some of them are looking back at us. And we have to adjust to that. And we have to then adjust our national policies to that reality.
So,
I'm sorry, Dave, go ahead.
Well, let me stop you right there, because national policy is what I want to shift your focus to.
Sure.
So let's make the assumption that an announcement is made by the end of 2004 that some form of primitive, biological, recognizable life exists on Mars, and
right.
There now is an imperative to get there. So I want to now shift the focus, and I want to ask you, can we, not necessarily the United States we, but can we, those spacefaring nations here on Earth, can we muster up, A, the spirit, and two, B, the technology and engineering to get to Mars pretty quickly? And can the private sector do it, or does this have to be a government or multi-government deal?
I think the answer to your question, if there was a definitive announcement by a group of scientists with data that was pretty much unassailable, as I believe they're developing a body of evidence now, that there is life or there was life or is life on Mars. In fact, if there was life on Mars, there would most certainly be life now. One and the other are intertwined. Now, say if there was that announcement with the evidence that was unassailable, I think that would have passed through the human psyche like an electric shock. And I think that very quickly you would find a consortium of nations, basically the Space Station Alliance, perhaps joined by China, would immediately begin planning for a human Mars effort. And I believe it's very much within our technological abilities to do that. It's just a question of money. It's also a question of how much perceived value of the American public and the rest of the world would believe that there would be in landing human beings on Mars, given that Mars was a living planet. I think that the American public and the European public would very quickly decide that it was of incalculable value, and therefore even spending a large sum of money on this would not be unreasonable. I view the Apollo sum of, like $24 to $30 billion as a kind of reasonable sum to get to Mars. I think that could be done with the new technologies, particularly electric propulsion, which I work on. We have a rocket engine that runs on microwaves. The microwaves, of course, have to be made from solar power or nuclear power, but best they can be made with solar power most easily. And the microwaves are then focused in a chamber down to a point and form an electrodeless plasma discharge. And then water vapor is formed in a vortex and goes through this ball of plasma and is heated to blue-white heat and produces very, very good performance. We reported this at a conference in Baltimore on plasma physics recently, and we're getting just really good performance out of this. This means for You could accumulate the water to go to Mars with, over years. You can store water in orbit. You can move water from one spacecraft to another in orbit. They do it all the time on the space station. And this means for 80 tons of water, which is about as much water as your swimming pool in your backyard, you could put 30 tons at Mars. And 30 tons would support like a 3-people mission. One of the other problems they do about the Mars mission, and I've proposed an architecture for a Mars mission, a human Mars mission, is they keep saying, well, we have to have 6 people in the crew. And I said, oh, no, you just need 3 people. And if you do that, it basically halves the cost. If you use solar electric propulsion using a system like I'm working on or another system like ion thrusters using the Russian Hall thrusters using solar electric, then you can get to Mars without too much expense.
But NASA wants to do nuclear power to go to Mars.
Actually, they don't really want to do nuclear power to go to Mars. They discuss that. The nuclear mission they talk about is to Jupiter. And I've had some... I love to hear Bob Zubrin talk about this thing. And basically,
Mars Direct.
Mars Direct, but we can get to Mars with chemical rockets or electric propulsion using solar. He's glad the nuclear spaceship is going to Jupiter and not anywhere near Mars, basically. In fact, sending a nuclear rocket to Mars is a little bit of overkill. It isn't really necessary, and it involves a lot of controversy and a lot of technological development that you don't really need to. If all you wanted to do was spend money to get to Mars, if going to Mars was sort of incidental to spending a lot of money, then you would have a nuclear rocket to get to Mars. If you just want to go to Mars, then there are a lot easier and cheaper ways to get to Mars than developing a nuclear rocket. We don't have a nuclear rocket right now, but we have a lot of chemical rockets, and that's the beauty of Bob Zubrin's Mars Direct, is it basically uses simple extrapolation of present technologies. It's not a boondoggle.
So the other half of the question,
yes,
that I ask you is, okay, we've got life over on Mars. It's confirmed, even if it's
and
real
then,
simple.
And then, by the way, and that means we have to go there.
And we have to go there now. $25-30 billion is a lot of money. Can
sure.
The private sector take this on? Are we absolutely committed to this being a multi-government project?
I think that you really have to make it a multi-government project. The European Union is very prosperous. There's a lot of wealth on this planet, and I think that $25 billion, $50 billion for a Mars mission, especially spread over the United States and Russia and Europe and the Chinese wanted to prove that they were a great nation all by themselves, and they may or may not join. But at the same time, that isn't that much money. That much money changes hands on the global currency markets every day. I'm sure, sums that dwarf $50 billion change hands daily on the currency markets. So I think that's almost just a little bit of noise on the system.
Okay, hold on a minute. We're coming up on the end of the first hour with our listeners in Seattle and KKNW. So first of all, I want to thank everyone in Seattle for tuning in and being with us tonight. And for those of you that can, when we break at the top of the hour, if you can switch over to live365.com and just type in the Space Show in the search box, you can hear the balance of the program tonight. If you can't do that, the program, including this special edition portion, will be archived at thespaceshow.com sometime tomorrow. It'll probably be on Live 365 in a loop stream later tonight. Make sure you hear the balance of it, because there's a lot more that Dr. Brandenburg is about to tell us, even if he doesn't know it. Okay, John, in
all right.
The last... couple of minutes here for the Seattle listeners.
Okay, I will just say that the ultimate political question, involving extraterrestrial life is extraterrestrial intelligence and our political relationship with it. When we talk of human race moving out into space, becoming spacefaring, making a society that's multiplanetary, we're assuming that our nearest neighbors are not going to interfere with that. We're assuming that we are pretty much alone in space, and we can basically do everything that we want to do without consulting anybody else. And that is a big supposition. I think, however, it's a fairly good one. The universe may be very sparsely populated with intelligence, such as ourselves. That would be a good thing, by the way. But it is an assumption. Once you admit that there's extraterrestrial life, and then extraterrestrial intelligence follows very quickly from that, from admitting that, then you must admit extraterrestrial intelligence. Then you have to ask a question, how close are they? What will be the nature of our ultimate interaction with them? And that's the ultimate political question. And it raises so many questions at once that people tend to have tended, they're going to postpone that question for as long as they can. However, in the novel I wrote about the collapse of the UFO cover-up. In a sense, the government is already dealing with that question, however, in a covert way. And when the covert program fails, not only is there a constitutional crisis, but there's an attempted coup d'etat between, there's a struggle for political power between those who want to make an accommodation with the aliens and those who refuse to. So, in a sense, it's a science fiction novel. But we're trying to draw maps of the new territory that we'll occupy once we find life on Mars.
Okay. I'm trying to think if we have enough. Nope, that music is coming in my ears. So
I knew I could hear that music coming, Dave. I wrapped up that my little. I got off my soapbox just in time.
Well, I've got some great questions coming up on the next segment that have been coming in by email.
Great.
We're still looking for an answer to this question as to who the first woman was to fly in space, and then you win the book Space Trivia. Written by astronaut Pogue. So thank you all, Seattle, for tuning us in tonight. We'll be back next Tuesday night. We'll be back on Sunday for the Sunday Space Show. And on behalf of our guest, Dr. Brandenburg, and myself, we wish those of you who have to sign off right now a really good week, a prosperous, happy, and successful week.
Live
take
long
care,
and
all.
Prosper.
Absolutely. John, stand by. Welcome to the special edition portion of the Space Show. This is your host, Dr. David Livingston, and our guest today, Dr. John Brandenburg. And we are here for the special edition, and I have convinced Dr. Brandenburg to stay with us for an extra 15 minutes or so. So this special edition program will go to 8:30 Pacific time. John, this is a fabulous and truly interesting discussion, and it's about to get a little bit more interesting with this question that Bruce in Phoenix would like to ask you by email.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce says, we are in the midst of a terrible war against an enemy using terror as a main technique, but who would like to see most of us dead and the other group of us living in something close to their vision of a 12th or 13th century existence.
Yes.
What do you think the announcement of life on Mars will do to our war against terror, and how will it radicalize or affect the people actually carrying out the terror war? Will it make our enemies more steadfast, or what do you think the impact will be on the terrorist wanting to resume a 13th century existence once they know we're not alone in the universe?
Oh, that's a very fascinating question. Thank you for that. I believe that the more this society demonstrates scientific advancement, the more we will triumph over the 13th century frame of mind. I think discovery of a life on Mars will hammer the Islamic fundamentalists.
What if we discover 72 virgins on Mars?
Well, that raises a question, Steve.
That's right. That's when the government really goes into a conspiracy and silences all the findings, right?
I have a joke in this novel I'm writing. One of the characters says to the two female journalists, and one's a rookie, and the veteran is saying to the rookie, "Well, we did get a man bites a dog story one night, but we had to spike it." And the rookie says, "Why was that?" She said, "The man was from outer space." The war on terror is a psychological war more than anything else. And, I think that, to some extent, the fact that I would really like for us to emphasize more space things because, right now we're in a situation where we're basically having to find these terrorists, you know, hunt down these terrorists relentlessly and get them before they can launch any more attacks on us. And that's going to be kind of that's a long-term process. And in the end, it's kind of a negative process. What I would really like to do is advance the world so that the world thinks differently about all of these questions. And ultimately, the world loses interest in this whole struggle between East and West, and is basically they're all standing in their backyards at night looking at the stars. And once they do that long enough, I think they're going to decide that it's silly and pointless to argue about whether Sharia should be the law of the land in the United States or not. Obviously, it's not going to be. But that's Islamic law.
Not in my lifetime, it's not going to be.
Not while I'm alive, no. That's... And and other of these characters who generally do want to conquer the world. It's been a long time since we run into people who generally wanted to conquer the world. You know, the Russians, the Soviets, entertained notions of conquering the world for about the first 20 years of communism, but after that they kind of set it aside. But we've actually run into some characters who now really do want to conquer the world. But part of their failure will be that the world will just get larger. It'll get so much larger so rapidly that they will decide to go do something else of their lives.
Wilmer,
they're typically very enterprising personalities. I'm sure they'll find something else useful to do.
Wilma in Boston has this question for you. 50 years ago, or maybe 100 years ago, science did not seriously entertain the possibility of life on Mars. And now our science is being turned upside down and pretty rapidly.
Yeah.
What is the likelihood that our current view of life on Venus or Mercury or someplace else, Jupiter, Neptune, or even far out on Pluto, which is that it can't exist for a variety of reasons, gets turned upside down in 50 years or 30 years with new exploration and new information, and we find that there can be life and, in fact, are various forms of life on some of these other planets? Is that possible?
I think that's a very interesting question that she has raised. I think inevitably we will find different chemical systems and even perhaps systems involving not even chemistry as we understand it that actually are a form of biology. In other words, something that takes in energy and uses it for metabolism and then expels
what the, you know, it takes energy and basically reproduces. And I think that we will find that just as we're finding now that the boundaries, the envelope within which we thought even carbon-based life could exist is so much broader than we ever imagined. You know, they find bacteria that live in the center of swimming pool nuclear reactors going full blast. They find bacteria living in places where there isn't even organic matter. They basically grab particles of carbon out of the rock with, and mix it with water and make all of their own chemicals, the extremophiles. And one of the reasons I decided to start writing science fiction was to revel in that idea that the universe is so full of life and vitality, and that one of the science fiction scenarios I'm entertaining, and some of the characters in my novels are actually newscasters, so they get to read the news to everybody. They get to make these great announcements in the middle of these novels as kind of sidebar things,
mm-hmm.
and to kind of spice up the plot. It's the idea that as they drill, they do some deep drilling, they discover silicone life. Not silicon life, but silicone life. And we're not talking about breast enhancement. We're talking about that they find varieties of life that actually start incorporating silicon, in, you know, instead of carbon, in with the carbon in the organic molecules. And they have a lot of plastics that are based on what's called silicone, which is substituting silicon atoms, which are chemically similar to carbon, into organic molecules. And they're very heat resistant. So you have life that can basically live in at 500 degrees. And not even break a sweat. And it lives deep within the earth. And as they drill deeper, they finally find that this life finally starts substituting more and more silicon and other elements in for the carbons and nitrogens and hydrogens that we're used to. And finally is a completely different chemistry. And it lives, instead of finding this on Mercury or something like that, you actually find it, you know, 10 miles down in the earth itself. And basically they find that that some of the weirdest forms of life they could possibly imagine are actually terrestrial. And I don't know, I just it's a thought, something I will probably incorporate into my later science fiction, and that's one of the reasons I write science fiction, is to, you know, entertain new ideas and of course entertain an audience.
And not to be trounced on by your peers, right?
That's my peers, my other science, yeah, my other...
Your physics peers.
My physics peers, oh, that's right. One of the nice things about being able to write science fiction, especially under a pen name, people ask me, what do you believe? And I said, which one, Victor Norgaard or John Brandenburg? Victor Norgaard believes all conspiracy theories.
Do you, if there is some... form or a lot of different forms of life throughout the galaxy on different planets, do the laws and rules of physics have to be the same as what we know them to be on Earth? I know they could be far more advanced.
Well, also, you must remember that our understanding of even physics as it's present on this planet is incomplete. I carry my work on space propulsion, I dabble in very advanced propulsion things like using Kaluza-Klein theory, which is the basis for the string theory. If you like, string theory applied to advanced propulsion. And there may be physics that we don't understand presently or haven't even seen yet. Like Hawking, I don't know what Hawking believes now, but he was the one who first proposed that you have little micro black holes and then they would evaporate from quantum processes.
Uh-huh.
And those processes, what they really do is they convert gravitational energy, gravitons basically, quanta of gravity,
into photons, particles of electromagnetism. So basically, you would have an organized gravity field. When his black holes would evaporate, they would basically have an organized gravity field full of gravity energy, which would basically go unstable and fall apart and disintegrate into electromagnetic radiation. And according to Sakharov, the great Russian scientist, the essence of gravity is electromagnetic. So I could imagine animals that actually use some process that converts gravitational energy into electromagnetic energy for their own metabolism. One of the great books written by Arthur C. Clarke is not the Space Odyssey. It was Childhood's End, which was a very interesting scenario of the human race coming in contact with a vast extraterrestrial intelligence. And one of the things that the children of this last generation of the human race that was coming into contact psychically was doing was they were exploring other planets psychically, and he had this tableau of all these fascinating planets where life based on processes that were very remote to anything on Earth were occurring. And I just thought it was really neat. It's worth reading just for that. And
what's the name of it again?
Childhood's End.
Childhood.
It's also a classic in terms of one view of what the future of the human race is in the living cosmos. And his view, the human race was going to be barred from visiting the stars. It was going to be barred from becoming spacefaring by the other species around it.
Kind of like Moses not getting into the promised land, right?
Right. It was like we were considered too dangerous, too warlike, too primitive, too ill-mannered.
How do they get that idea?
Just watching on news. Watching the Amber Fry testimony in the Peterson trial. And so basically, they basically intervened, and the human race's destiny was completely different than from becoming Captain Kirk on the Starship Enterprise. We were going to be evolved completely psychically rather than technologically. And so we were kind of absorbed finally into this giant overmind. It was kind of, was very much an idea of kind of Eastern mysticism of kind of an impersonal God absorbing us into itself. And I thought it was called a very fascinating book. It was a brilliant book and had a lot of, it was very fascinating intellectually. But like the characters in my book say, this is the end of our childhood. It is not childhood's end. Meaning they are rejecting that the human race is going to evolve on its own psychically. It's not going to be absorbed into anybody. In my novel, the question is whether the human race will be accept being absorbed into a large genetic empire of another race, basically. And they say this is the end of our childhood, the end of our naivety in the cosmos, but it is not childhood's end.
On my comment about the laws of physics being different, here's a question from Wanda in El Paso, Texas. She says, I have heard mentioned before on various radio programs or TV documentaries hyperdimensional physics. Is that a different type of physics that we're only now learning about, or how would your guest describe this?
Oh, yes. I would describe some of the research I'm doing is involving pure electromagnetic propulsion. If you take solar sailing, where you use the pressure of the sunlight from the sun to drive a spacecraft, you can sail around the solar system to any planet you like just using the radiation pressure of the sun, the electromagnetic pressure. And if you want to go like a trip to Pluto, which is far from the sun, and do that in a very rapid time scale, you can actually then put a nuclear power plant on your spaceship and make your big solar sail into a reflector, like a big flashlight beam, and a big searchlight, and basically create your own, carry your own sun with you, and basically you'll push yourself by this giant light bulb lit by a nuclear power plant. It will basically create all this light, and it will shine in a beam out from your spacecraft, and it will, you'll get the same reaction force as you would from a rocket engine. It'll be very weak, but it will be, it won't use any propellant, so you can go anywhere in the solar system you want without rocket fuel. Only energy. So that's pure electromagnetic propulsion. Now, if you go into Kaluza-Klein theory, which involves adding a fifth dimension. Now, let me tell you something. Superstring theory is based on what's called Kaluza-Klein theory. Kaluza and Klein, two great scientists, one Polish, one Swedish, showed that if you added a new hidden fifth dimension to the four dimensions of space-time, that you could unify, mathematically at least, electricity and magnetism. So in a sense, the pathway between electricity and magnetism lies through this fifth dimension. So that's a kind of that's an example of hyperdimensional physics. In hyperdimensional physics, in a five-dimensional world where one of these dimensions is a kind of hidden, compactified dimension, then gravity and E&M fields, you can basically go from one to the other uniformly. You can have mixed fields, partly gravity, partly E&M, etc. Now, the superstring people decided that if adding one dimension, one new dimension, a fifth dimension, gave you these marvelous things, then adding 11 new hidden dimensions would be even better. And then you have basically a full hyperdimensional theory. And I must confess, I don't understand that. I can only deal with, I'm trying to understand what adding one new dimension does to space-time, the fifth dimension. And, but that's unifying electricity and magnetism can be done by adding a fifth dimension. And this is, and when you do that, you have, a sense, this, the most primitive form of hyperdimensional physics, but it gets you a lot. I published a theory called the gem theory, which is, stands for the Latin phrase grandis et medianus, or the great and the medium. It also means just gravity and E&M, and it's basically a Kaluza-Klein theory. And, it's great fun. It's occupied many, a very pleasant Sunday afternoon, scribbling equations on endless yellow legal tablets. But, yes. By mastering some of these hyperdimensional physics theories, we will be able to understand some of what happens in the universe, and we may find life that uses hyperdimensional processes, such as converting gravitational energy into E&M energy, splitting up gravitons into photons, like and using the photons to drive photosynthesis, a form of photosynthesis, something like that. So, yes, Wanda, I think that understanding hyperdimensional physics will help us to prepare ourselves for finding life that perhaps uses other processes.
Question for you on something that I've never really grasped. Maybe you can explain it. The pressure of the sun's radiation on solar sails out in space can take you virtually any place.
Right.
Now, if I hold my hand up in the sunlight, I don't feel any pressure.
Yeah, that's because the pressure is very weak.
Well, obviously.
1 watt of sunlight produces 1 nanonewton. A newton is about, 2 pounds, that's 1 kilogram, produces about 10 newtons of force. So that's about, a billionth of a pound of force is being felt by your hand. The wind blowing against your hand produces much more force.
Clearly.
This is why electromagnetic propulsion is not really considered very practical right now. The best way to use electromagnetic propulsion is to use the sun, which gives you all this electromagnetic energy for free. If you have to generate the electromagnetic energy yourself, then this is a very slow boat to China, basically. It's a very slow way to travel. But you don't need any rocket fuel.
So you're basically...
Great mileage.
basically this infinitely weak pressure,
yes,
from the sun, and I guess as you go out to Pluto, it gets even weaker.
That's right. It falls off as 1/r², just like... But so it falls off at the same rate as the gravity force, so... One way you can actually do the equations is that you basically reduce the amount of gravity from the sun. You're basically using the electromagnetic field emitted by the sun, the sunlight, to reduce the effective gravitational force from the sun. Mathematically, you can do that. That's not what's happening physically. Physically, you're putting up a big plastic sheet covered with aluminum to reflect the sunlight, and it's managing a large solar sail like that is a real engineering problem. But it can be done. The Japanese are going to launch a satellite soon that will actually test this.
About 2 weeks ago, I did a program with Dr. Lake Mirabeau.
Oh, Lake Mirabeau.
He dropped a bombshell on me that I had really never thought about just toward the end of the program, and it hasn't really left me. So I want to bombshell you with this one.
This is your best shot.
We were talking about his beamed propulsion and laser propulsion, which is what he works
right
on. And the question came up about the suborbital vehicles and chemical rockets, and then the next generation, which most likely would be some sort of orbital reusable vehicle. And I made a comment about the heat shielding of an orbital vehicle, and he talked about how much progress had been made in the heat shielding. But he said the real thing is that anybody who's out there, and I'm sort of bastardizing his and paraphrasing what he had to say, but he said anyone out there who's really doing this with chemical rockets is already probably on a losing streak. Those are my words. They really need to be looking at reusable orbital vehicles using these newer launch technologies and access technologies, because we're at pretty much the peak of what chemical rockets are going to ever be able to do, and we're not going to get that much more out of them. And to put all of the R&D that's required to build a truly reusable orbital vehicle and then stick it up there with chemical rockets when it should be up there with beamed energy or laser or even having the source of power on the moon or, you know, orbiting Earth is a real waste of resources and money.
I tend to agree to a certain extent with his statement. Chemical rockets, I worked on I was on a space transportation subcommittee. I had a great honor of serving there with a lot of very fine men and some women too. And we were studying the single stage to orbit problem, and basically we were reviewing the programs being done at Lockheed and the Skunk Works and things like this. And the design for a truly reusable launch vehicle that was single stage to orbit, completely reusable, just like an airliner, the thing was basically a balloon. It was just a giant rocket tank. That's all it was. I mean, it had a very tiny compartment for, imagine just a regular rocket. Imagine the space shuttle with the big fuel tank moved inside it. So it's like a pregnant guppy. And it's just, they were pretty bizarre designs. Some of them were very good, but still, they were so caught up in the problem that chemical fuels can only give you a certain amount of bounce per ounce. And finally, you're up liquid hydrogen, oxygen. That's the best you can do. Nobody wants fluorine in liquid hydrogen, which doesn't really give that much more better performance. So you just were stuck with these things, trying to make tanks for liquid hydrogen that were very, very light and yet would withstand the cold of liquid hydrogen and not leak. And it turned out to be pretty much impossible given present materials. It was, but still, even the look of them was basically just a big balloon with an engine on the bottom and a little cargo space on the top. And so Lake Mirabeau is correct in saying that that is probably, we're probably not going to do a lot better than we can do now with a good Delta rocket or, watching people do the XPRIZE, they've had some unsuccessful flights, and it's a big problem. And, rocket science remains very, very tricky. One person joked that if you want to make us, the idea of commercializing new low-cost launch vehicles, one guy commented, he said, if you want to make a small fortune in commercial rocketry to orbit, he said, start with a large fortune. You'll end up spending most of your money to basically create rockets that are, still not much better than what we have on the pad right now, and probably don't earn you that much money per launch. So but Elon Musk has been, we're hoping he'll launch his Falcon, and I hope he makes $1 billion from it. I really do. He deserves it.
Well, absolutely, and hopefully he will be totally successful with what he's doing, and the same with Spaceship One, and there's a Canadian
right.
team.
Yeah,
Canadian teams.
I was really excited by the Spaceship One test flight. It was actually a very dangerous. Turned into a dangerous adventure, which they didn't want to have happen, but. That's what this is all about, actually. It's a rather swashbuckling adventure. And of course, things went wrong. And at one point, he said, what am I doing here 60 miles above the Earth's surface in danger of tumbling out of control? And but I must also say that what Lake Mirabeau is proposing is that we build some really big lasers or microwave beam things, and the power required to lift stuff into space, chemical rockets are the only thing we have that can provide the power, the sheer amount of energy expended within 200 seconds to get stuff into orbit. If we had to do that with electric power beamed by laser, that would be a really big laser. And you would want everyone to get indoors and not look, because even the stray light bouncing off the spacecraft, the light that would bounce off the spacecraft rather than making thrust would blind people at 10 miles away, I think, when it launched. So you'd have to be really careful. But it would be exciting.
Absolutely.
And I more power to him.
I still think it'd be exciting to get to see a Saturn V launch. So.
Oh, yes. Yes, it would be. We'll probably see something like that again in the coming years.
Well, John, I have kept you way over the original time, and I know it's extremely late where you are.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dave. Always a pleasure to be on your program.
And so I do want to thank you for being the guest today. And we got to do this more often. This has been an absolute joy and lots of good information. And I appreciate your coming on at the last minute. And we'll get you back on here pretty quickly. And
I'm writing another science fiction novel.
Well, people,
we can talk about that.
Absolutely,
another spacey novel, by the way.
And
surprise.
Morningstar Press is still current. So for those of you that have not yet. Had a chance to look at it or read it.
The Collapse of the UFO Cover-Up by Victor Norgaard, a.k.a. John Brandenburg, and be obtained on Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. They've got some good reviews up. It's got good reviews.
Absolutely.
Just Google it.
And it's a good read. So I want to thank you very much for being with us, and thank everybody for staying with us way past the scheduled time. But you've been worth it, and I'll look forward to doing it again with you real soon.
Oh, Dave, we're going to have a great time in the coming years. Right?
Absolutely.
Lots of exciting stuff to talk about.
For John and myself, good night all, and thank you for having joined the Space Show this week.
Live long and prosper.
That's right.
Okay, Dave.
Good night.